The following program is intended for an audience of blind and print-impaired persons and is brought to you from the North Carolina Reading Service. That program is called Indie Week, The Independent, and is brought to you weekly and read this week by John Federson. The issue is dated June the 6th of 2025. So you're all settled back in your chairs and ready for about an hour's worth of civics, entertainment bulletins, and food articles when I can find them. And let's get started. All right, and as continuing the last several weeks of articles from Indie Week, which, by the way, is also found online at indieweek.com, budgets and school budgets particularly tend to get a good size share of the print articles, and here's one about Wake County's passing its budget with a small tax increase to support schools. The Board of Commissioners passed its $2.1 billion budget for fiscal 26 last night, following a months-long process that involved a good deal of hand-wringing and compromise. The final total includes a last-minute $5 million increase to the appropriation for Wake County Public Schools, prompted by weeks of advocacy and public pressure. The county's allocation to the public schools will increase by $40 million next year, but will still fall far short of the school's stated need by about $20 million. In May, County Manager David Ellis proposed a $35 million increase, but the county commissioners decided last night to give the system the full $40 million it requested. In the intervening month, Wake teachers, students, parents, and the board has stressed the need for the county to contribute as much as it could. According to the board chair, Susan Evans, Ellis and his staff budgeted with the intention of keeping property tax increases as low as possible this year. Evans said, "We know people are struggling." The budget math was complicated further by high inflation and a looming recession, according to Ellis's budget message. That means very few new programs or major investments in this budget beyond core services like education and emergency response. Wake County taxpayers will see a slight property tax increase of 0.36 cents in the upcoming fiscal year, bringing that tax rate to about 50 cents per $100 property valuation. For households valued at the median $450,000, that translates to an annual tax bill of about $2,300, not including municipal taxes. Of the increase, 25 cents, a quarter of a penny, will generate revenue for the library bond voters approved last November, and 0.11 cents will go to the schools. In addition to funding Wake County Public Schools to the tune of $1.2 billion in capital and operating costs, the budget includes $258 million for public safety, $133.8 million for Wake Tech, $7.7 million for libraries. The county is also setting aside money to build a new animal shelter and increase staff pay by 1 to 3.5%. They'll spend about $743 million on operating costs for the schools in the coming fiscal year, a figure commissioners said would be lower if the state paid its fair share. Commissioner Cheryl Stallings said this, "We are in this challenging position because the majority in our state legislature continues to underfund their constitutional responsibility to our schools' operating expenses." County Manager Ellis proposed, and the commissioners approved, the elimination of 12 Wake County Emergency Medical Service positions and a $1 million annual reduction to the county's Housing Opportunity Fund, which is a new loan fund the county is launching over the next 5 years. Monday's vote was 6-1, with only the Commissioner Shanika Thomas voting in opposition. Thomas said, by way of explanation for her no vote, "This is not a vote against Wake County Public Schools. This is a vote for responsible planning, fairness, and sustainability. I support public education. I also support emergency response and affordable housing. This should not be an either-or decision. I won't break housing and public safety to fix schools. That's not leadership. It's triage." Thomas wasn't the only commissioner with misgivings about the budget. Several of her colleagues also said they felt they'd been handed a nearly impossible choice between supporting public education and the county's other programs. Commissioner Vicki Adamson said, "This has been a tough budget, second only to the budget we had to do at the beginning of COVID. Cutting housing and EMS is painful." She added, "If the county ends up with more revenue than anticipated, she and her colleagues will ask that it be put toward restoring those EMS positions and the housing program that were cut." Evans got the last word before the vote, and she said her time as a board member gives her a unique perspective on the county's responsibility to public schools. She emphasized that the Housing Opportunity Fund is not going to disappear, saying, "We're not cutting any existing programs when it comes to housing. This was a new initiative. It's still going to be a new initiative. We're just cutting back in scope a little bit on how we kick it off." She added that Wake County expects to fill those 12 EMS positions in fiscal 2027, saying, "I acknowledge that other members of the board had their reasons for not going to support this amendment. Their viewpoints are completely valid and respected. However, I am completely comfortable with the choice that I have made," she said. Continuing over to Durham and the Durham Public Schools, this question: how would DPS adjust if it doesn't get its full budget request? This is entered on yesterday by Chase Pellegrini DuPauer, the author. "The Durham County Board of Commissioners is on track for a final vote Monday on its $1 billion 25-26 budget, and all of the line items, see 43 new vehicles for the sheriff, 12 new EMS personnel. The county's public school system is set to be its single highest expenditure. DPS Board of Education asked the county to fund a $222 million operating budget, which would be about a $16 million increase from last year. The county manager in her draft budget countered with a $10 million increase. Anything and everything is subject to change in the week before final approval. Last year, for example, DPS requested a roughly $27.7 million increase. The then county manager countered with $13 million, and the commission eventually met the board at $27 million. But the board is already planning for the worst while hoping for the best. In a recent meeting, Chief Financial Officer Jeremy Titor walked the board through a budget exercise that showed how the district may cut back some plans if it does not get the full increase it sought. "Here's where the board asks may stand if the county doesn't meet the full request. Non-negotiable, $6.3 million in continuation costs. Like the rest of us, they deal with a world that continues to get more and more expensive. The district, for example, anticipates a $200,000 increase in its utility bills. DPS needs an additional $6.3 to maintain operations, so a majority of the increase from the county, whether it's $10 or $16 million, would go to literally just staying open for another year. While keeping the lights on is certainly a low bar, Durham is not alone in facing school funding challenges this year. Orange County's manager initially presented a proposal that would not even meet the county's school district's continuation needs. Wake's allocation to its school will increase by $40 million next year, but will still fall short of the stated need by about $20 million. Non-negotiable, $2 million more to charter schools. Under law, districts are required to transfer an amount equal to the per pupil share of public school funding to charter schools, i.e., the dollars follow the student. So the county can't increase funding to DPS without doing the same for charters. Of the DPS $700 million total budget last year, about $43 million of local taxpayer money passed through to charters, along with 8,200 students. And it is likely to be fully funded, $1.1 million for additional exceptional children support. The board indicated they would likely commit $1.1 to exceptional children services, regardless of the county's final amount. The state provides additional per-student funding for students with special needs, but only for up to 13% of the total district enrollment. Teeter told the county commissioner at a work session last week that about 16.5% of DPS students would qualify for that funding. Ideally, he said, the state would provide $5.5 million, but until that happens, DPS will ask the county to foot the bill, saying, we maybe don't need to come in front of you looking for $5.5 million for that, but we can try to stagger that over time, slowly close that gap, and continue to monitor how the state may or may not adjust. Likely still in, but reduced, bus driver supplements. The board's initial budget request proposed $377,000 to fund $200 monthly supplements for bus drivers. While the board indicated they would still favor that original amount, Teeter indicated that district administration may recommend $150 supplements instead. At the commission's May 27th public hearing on the budget, DPS veteran bus driver Ritha Daniel Ruth asked the commission to fully fund the $16 million requested increase, which would include that $200 supplement. Telling the commission, we have suffered budget cuts. We have suffered reallocations of our money. We had suffered disrespect from our administration. I do extra duty as much as possible, not because I want to, because my household budget demands it. Many days I work continually from 6:15 a.m. till 7 p.m. at night. She added that students will sometimes tell her they want to be bus drivers for DPS when they grow up. She said, I would love to tell them to work for DPS. Sometimes I can't because of what I'm going through right now. Next item. Likely still in, but reduced, local pay supplement increase for teachers. The initial request asked for $2.3 million to increase the local salary supplement it gives teachers each year by about $700 per teacher. With a smaller increase from the county, board members would consider a smaller supplement, possibly around $300. Durham gives among the highest supplements in the state, about $10,000, surpassed only by neighboring Wake and Chapel Hill. That supplement helps Durham attract and retain talented educators because the state's starting teacher pay is less than appealing, roughly $40,000. Likely in, but it's complicated, master's pay. Before 2013, the state government provided additional pay to educators with master's degrees. Wake and Durham are the only counties that have decided to bring that extra pay back in recent years at a cost to local taxpayers. Who exactly qualifies for that pay has been the subject of much consternation for the school board. Last year's budget only allowed for master's pay for 170 educators. While the proposed $16 million increase from the district would allow DPS to provide this to all eligible certified staff, including 358 teachers and 11 social workers. The board looked recently at the cost of expanding master's pay to all eligible certified staff, but at lower amounts, if DPS only receives the $10 million increase. The board seemed interested in expanding it to all eligible staff at 5% of the base pay, while the administration eyed 4%. And that concludes that article about the Durham budget. But we're not through with Durham education. The school board approved a modified meet and confer policy in a split vote, in a 4-3 vote. After an hours-long discussion last week, Public Schools Board of Ed approved a historic meet and confer policy again. That contentious discussion brought the April policy, which the board previously passed in, yes, another contentious 4-3 vote, more in line with the version favored by the Durham Association of Educators. But at a press conference Tuesday, complete with a smiling group photo at the end, all of the involved parties did their best to make sure no journalist could accuse them of any lingering contention. The triumvirate of School Board Chair Millicent Rogers, DPS Superintendent Anthony Lewis, and Durham Association of Educators President Mika Toitmeyer celebrated the historic policy that gives employee groups guaranteed meetings with the superintendent several times a year. For more on that, what they will actually look like, there is another article in Indy, Meet and Confer Explainer. Rogers said, in response to Indy's question about unity after the pair of split votes, "We fully support the policy. Knowing each of my colleagues, the way we vote speaks to the questions, concerns we have in that moment. It does not speak to our ability to move forward together." To that point, 6 of 7 board members did vote for versions of the policy, just at different times and in different coalitions, in those 4-3 votes. The April version, which DAE did not support, was the result of a surprise vote called by board member Natalie Bayer. Although she noted at the time the policy could be modified in the future. The board members who voted against approval in April, Joy Harrell Goff, Emily Chavez, and Wendell Tabb, wanted to wait till they had a version that the DAE supported. Most of that contention in April was around how large a worker group needed to be to gain a seat at the meet and confer table. Lewis suggested that worker groups, including DAE, should get a seat if they can demonstrate they represent at least 6% of the district's non-administrative staff. DAE countered that other groups operating in bad faith could technically qualify for recognition and ruin the meetings for all the organization, and suggested a 30% threshold. The board settled at 6%. Last week, Harold Goff, Chavez, and Vice Chair Jessica Carter-Outen led the charge to raise it to 11% over the objections of Bayer, Rogers, and Tabb. Bettina Umstead voted for that jump to 11%, but expressed discomfort with the process. No kidding. DAE represents over 50% of the public DPS workers, and no other organization has demonstrated enough support to reach any of the aforementioned thresholds. On an issue of possibly wider-ranging scope, Chapel Hill High School students walk into woods for Palestine protest following a dispute with the administration. The 50 Chapel Hill High students who walked out Thursday morning, last Thursday, and marched across the street a quarter mile into the woods to protest what they call the, quote, intensification of genocide by Israel in Gaza, would have preferred to stage their demonstration on campus. Sophomore Finn McElwee said, "We wanted to work with the administration to hold the walkout on campus and make the event as safe as possible, but students ultimately decided to relocate after negotiations with the administration broke down." According to McElwee, who approached administrators with plans for the walkout several weeks ago, Administrators wanted student organizers to submit in advance everything anyone would say during the demonstration. This posed a particular problem because organizers had planned an open mic portion. McAway says administrators also told organizers that students' use of the word genocide would be, quote, challenged during the review process. Rather than accept those conditions, the students chose to hold their demonstration off school property. The walkout comes as the humanitarian crisis in Gaza remains, as McAway put it, quote, apocalyptic. According to Gaza Health Ministry, nearly 56,000 people have been killed since the war began, including more than 10,000 children and hundreds of journalists and aid workers. Gaza's 2.1 million residents are facing mass starvation after months of blockade. Despite the blockade ending in mid-May, humanitarian groups say insufficient aid is being allowed into the territory to prevent famine. Chapel High disputes the characterization of conversations with the administration, and in a statement to Indy, Chief Communications Officer Andy Jenks at Chapel Hill Carborough wrote, quote, students were not told they could not use that word, but rather that they should be mindful of their word choices in the school environment. Jenks wrote, this feels like a mischaracterization of what is otherwise our normal steps for addressing student-led events and their associated flyers and posters and verbiage. Our school made every reasonable effort to allow them to hold a peaceful event on campus, as is their right, and the students eventually chose otherwise. McAway believes the school's concerns around word choice were directly related to criticism the school received after a similar walkout in support of Palestine last year. McAway says, I was told by my principal that during the walkout that happened last year, student protesters used the term genocide, and then the school was verbally attacked by organizations like Voice for Israel. McAway says, Chapel Hill High Principal Stephen Sullivan told him, quote, we didn't realize the implications of this term at the time of last year's walkout. Well, Sullivan and Jenks did not directly address these claims about those specific statements when contacted for comment. Jenks disputes that the school's actions were shaped by past criticism, stating that while the school did receive messages from outside organization after last year's walkout, its approach has always been driven by concerns for, quote, the physical and social-emotional well-being of everyone at school. Whether or not last year's messages influenced this year's approach, Voice for Israel of North Carolina did mobilize community members to contact Chapel Hill High administrators in the days leading up to the walkout. In a Wednesday newsletter obtained by the Indy, the organization warned members about the walkout and stated, quote, it had contacted local parents who quickly moved into advocacy to protect Jewish students. Jenks says ahead of Thursday's walkout, the school received 6 emails from people asking that it take steps to prevent the demonstration, none of whom were parents of current Chapel Hill High students. Voice for Israel did not respond to a request for comment. Several Jewish students were among the walkout's organizers and speakers, including Zev, who opened the demonstration by discussing the history of Jewish opposition to Zionism. Zed led pro-Palestine chants in both Yiddish and Palestinian Arabic, calling them, quote, two languages that are very suppressed by Israel. Throughout the demonstration, students look backward and forward in time while discussing the present day. They invoke the historical vindication of student movements. One student carried a sign reading, the students were right on civil rights, on Vietnam, on South African apartheid, on the genocide in Gaza, and speculated about how history will view this moment. One student said, in 20 years, people will look back on the people doing exactly this now and say, oh yeah, well, obviously they were in the right. Several others said, what we're doing is not wrong. Many expressed dismay at adults who had dismissed their activism and pushed back against characterizations of Israel-Palestine conflict as too complex to understand or act upon. One student said, "When all this stuff in Gaza and Israel started happening a couple of years ago, I spoke about it to my parents, and my dad said, 'It's complicated. You can't support one side over the other. It's not a genocide, and Israel isn't doing anything wrong.' But I had seen on the internet photos of bombed houses, so many bodies, children who were in pieces." About 20 minutes into the demonstration, two student counter-protesters arrived carrying Israeli flags. McAwee instructed participants not to engage with them. The counter-protesters told Indy they found the walkout to be anti-Semitic and made them feel unsafe. When asked to elaborate, one of them said, "First of all, I want to say that this walkout is not condoned by the school at all. There are going to be consequences for these students." "It is absurd to support what Hamas is doing," said the other protester. The board members who favored a lower threshold said they were worried about violating a state law that prohibits the board from giving any one employee group preferential treatment. Now, wait a minute. I'm reading the wrong article. That would conclude the article about that student protest. Pardon me. Probably my longest article from this issue, "The Welcome That Wasn't," was written by Hope Zhu. 2 days after Christmas 2024, Mangar arrived at Greensboro's Piedmont Triad International Airport in pouring rain. With him were his pregnant wife, six children, and four suitcases packed with a weight of 13 years from Kenya's refugee camps. He had never seen North Carolina. His only glimpse came from a pamphlet handed to him by the International Organization for Migration. It mentioned a museum, a coliseum, and some mountains. He remembered thinking, "This is an old city where people have lived a long time." Born in 1989 during Sudan's civil war, that's a conflict that killed more than 2 million, Mangar is Dinka, part of a Christian minority that bore the brunt of the fighting. The Assembly... By the way, the Assembly is a partner in publication to IndieWeek. The Assembly is withholding his last name due to security concerns. At 14, he was placed on a Red Cross flight to Lokichokio in northwest Kenya, then to Kakuma refugee camp, and later relocated to Dadaab, another settlement in the eastern part of the country. He waited nearly two decades for a call from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. It finally came when he was 36. He said, "I knew when a time like that would come, and I just feel prepared in every situation." While Mangar folded thick jackets for a winter he'd never known, Stephanie Chandler made calls. She works as a housing program manager at Church World Service Greensboro, helping newly arrived refugee families to find a roof to live under. She found them a three-bedroom unit tucked into a wooded part of central Greensboro, paid the deposit, and covered the first month's rent. She knew she was racing the clock. The country was about to install a president who had already once halted refugee resettlement and promised to do it again. For the staff and volunteers helping refugees rebuild their lives in the U.S., each arrival marked the end of a years-long journey through one of the world's most intensive vetting systems. Federal law defines a refugee as someone who cannot return home due to persecution or a well-founded fear of persecution based on race, religion, nationality, social group, or political opinion. Unlike asylum seekers who must already be in the U.S. or at a port of entry to request protection, refugees are vetted abroad and mostly referred by UNHCR, That's United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or U.S. embassies or non-governmental organizations. For years, the resettlement program stood on rare bipartisan ground. But as displacement surged, that consensus cracked. Unfounded fears associating with refugees with terrorism and economic strain crept in. Still, for many Americans, especially evangelical Christians, the work has always been more than politics. Resettlement is a moral calling, rooted in faith and a duty to shelter those in need. The economic argument, too, has gained strength. From 1990 to 2022, refugees added a net positive fiscal impact of over $123 billion. They opened businesses, joined the workforce, sometimes at rates higher than native-born citizens, despite greater barriers. Nearly 20,000 refugees have arrived in North Carolina over the past decade. In Durham and Greensboro, their presence is woven into streetscapes, Vietnamese sandwich shops squeezed between laundromats, trays of pistachio-studded baklava gleam behind glass, and on Sundays, gospel in Swahili, French, and English spills out of modest storefront churches. Adam Clark, a director of World Relief Durham, says even though refugee resettlement is a humanitarian program, and I wish that was enough for most people, it isn't always enough. The positive economic impact is becoming more and more part of our talking points. Refugees are just a very small slice of the total immigrant population, but even that small group brings over $8 billion to the U.S. each year. Church World Service, CWS, and World Relief are two of 10 nationwide organizations that hold a federal contract to support refugees with housing, education, and workforce preparation that can span years. As the second Trump term loomed, the end of those services sounded less like a possibility and more like a countdown. The past holds a reminder. In 2018, the Trump administration slashed the annual refugee cap to 45,000, the lowest since 1980. By May that year, 134 resettlement offices nationwide had shut down or been barred from taking new cases. The president alone sets the refugee cap, and with it, a lifeline. All North Carolina offices run by national resettlement agencies depend on the State Department's Refugee Bureau and the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement for roughly 80% of the budget. Without that money, they can't pay staff, secure apartments, or walk families through their first few weeks. This year, with Trump pledging more cuts on immigration programs, including ending the CPB One app for asylum seekers and rolling back temporary protected status for several nationals, including Haitians and Venezuelans, resettlement agencies rushed to act. Between September and December of last year, caseworkers and volunteers across North Carolina scrambled to place 924 newcomers, according to the State Department's data. They secured housing, arranged medical care, set up job interviews, knowing the refugee admissions again teetered on suspension in a sweeping rollback of immigration policy. Marian Abernathy, a leader of Durham-based Judea Reform Congregation's Refugee Resettlement and Immigrant Justice Project, warned her congregation and immigrant supporters in a newsletter last November, "Soon the gates will close, at least temporarily, to refugees and others seeking safety, as they did for our ancestors." And on January 20th, 2025, the State Department froze resettlement for a 90-day review. By May, the freeze still held, except for 59 white South Africans who landed in Virginia and were fast-tracked through an expedited program. Meanwhile, 10,000 refugees already cleared for arrival remained barred from entry. At a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing in May, senators pressed Secretary of State Marco Rubio on the freeze and the racial prioritization, to which Rubio responded, quote, "The United States has the right to pick and choose who they allow in." The freeze did not just stop the flow of newcomers. It pulled the floor out from under those already here. The order halted the reception and placement program, a lifeline for a refugee's first 90 days in the U.S. Chaos unfolded over February as those who arrived most recently became the most vulnerable. World Relief Triad said the freeze stripped support from 99 recent arrivals and cut off assistance to 300 others. Church World Service of Durham announced it was furloughing two-thirds of its staff who kept new arrivals housed and fed. Lutheran Service Carolina in Salisbury halted its aid to recent refugees. The Trump administration did not respond to a request for comment. Manga loves the news. While in the refugee camp, he scavenged every broadcast, magazine, and website. His first week in the U.S., he watched the inauguration on every screen. He'd heard the talk on immigration. He wasn't worried, and he said, "My arrival in the U.S. wasn't by chance. It was something that was given to me in a legal way, and I came here when the government knew I was coming." As his family moved into the apartment Chandler secured after 3 weeks in the extended stay hotel, Mangar's familiar itch to check the latest updates turned sour. The resettlement office was shrinking. The caseworker for Mangar's family is furloughed. Most questions his family had now went to the volunteers, Laurie and Len Nyland, who drove his wife to her prenatal check at nearby Cone Health Hospital and helped open the couple's first bank account. On February 5th, Chandler logged into the blog she's run since 2017 and wrote, "Our refugee resettlement office of 63 staff is now down to 18. She was among the 45 furloughed employees at Church World Service in Greensboro office, joining hundreds of resettlement workers who were let go in a single sweep in cities and towns across the country. Chandler described the first 3 days of furlough as traumatic, foggy, confusing, and heartbreaking. One moment she cried, the next time she was furious. "This is not just a terrible way to lose a job, it's painful, because the CWS team was the best." She's 55 and has lived in Greensboro for more than 30 years. Resettling refugees is what she calls her dream job, although it often feels like a scramble. Families raising from the size of one to a dozen sometimes arrive with just days to find housing in a city where options are slim. "I couldn't place them in fancy places," Chandler said, "but they were decent and safe." CWS now works with 8 housing providers across Greensboro, a step up from the past, when refugees were often placed in blighted neighborhoods. In 2018, a fire at the Summit Cone apartment claimed the lives of 5 Congolese children. A 2021 North Carolina Health News investigation revealed that such housing challenges are typical among refugee placements, with families frequently placed in substandard conditions due to agency haste and limited options. As resettlement agencies are laying off staff, refugees began knocking on the door of the community resource center serving immigrants like the Center for New North Carolinians, seeking better homes. Allison Krickenberger, program director at that center, said, "One guy came to me. He'd been followed home and beaten up. 5 people are still living in that apartment." She also saw a visible uptick in the number of clients asking for help to find jobs. One evening in March, as a soft dusk settled over Durham, Abernathy stood behind a small table inside the first floor of the 2-story synagogue. Beside her stood Bethany Showalter, interim director of the CWS Durham office. Her expression caught between hope and apology. in the auditorium. Students from the Duke Chorale tuned their voices for a concert supporting the emergency fund to stabilize new arrivals. Showalter, in a black blazer and a brittle smile, would soon face a crowd of retirees, many of whom had once personally sponsored refugees. Until just weeks earlier, they had all believed that new families were still on their way. She told the audience, "Our program has been built over the years, and we've tried to continue to make it better and make it more holistic. Seeing it being dismantled right now is incredibly disheartening. Being a welcoming presence, being a friend, goes a really long way. That cannot be taken away." She asked for any job leads for the nearly 200 refugees who arrived since October. The employment team at CWS, once 8 strong, had been cut down to 3. As she stepped down, Duke Chorale swelled into a song. "An eye for an eye, and the whole world goes blind. And how deep that darkness, and the light is nowhere to be found." Abernathy just didn't sit and listen. The same afternoon, she and her team walked into the office of an aide to Senator Tom Tillis, pressing for the resumption of admission. "I wish we were furnishing homes," she said, "meeting families at the airport, buying groceries, walking them through social services, doing what we're supposed to do." At January's end, she had sent Tillis a letter urging the same. He answered he was, quote, "sympathetic to the plight of refugees, many of whom are escaping persecution or civil war, but insisted immigration policy must continue to prioritize the needs of Americans." He added the president could raise admissions, quote, "at any time for an emergency situation." The assembly asked for further comments, but received none before we published this. Judea Reform Congregation's team has worked in resettlement since 2016, bolstering often underfunded agencies through the Syrian refugee crisis, Trump-era crackdowns, COVID-19 pandemic, and the Afghan influx after the fall of Kabul. In December, bracing for a program shutdown, Abernathy helped set up 2 welcome teams, part of a 2023 State Department effort to let Americans sponsor new arrivals. Homes were secured. Volunteers mapped grocery runs across the city. All of it came to a halt. She had seen refugee resettlement ebb and flow throughout the years, but nothing like this. "It's worse than 2016, she said. "The new arrivals stopped then, but there wasn't an order saying to stop services for those who are already here." The agency has already filed multiple lawsuits against the administration. As of May 6th, the U.S. government asked the Ninth Circuit of Court of Appeals to narrow or clarify its ruling in Pasito versus Trump, in which the court required that a select group of 160 refugees continue to be processed and supported. The court also called for post-arrival service and benefits cut off in February to be restored. By May 22nd, the administration confirmed it was working with agencies to help the same 160 who were supposed to travel within 2 weeks of January 20th, but it made no mention of others who had already arrived in the country, many just days before the freeze, and who were still waiting for the service they'd been promised. JRC helped welcome at least 50 people in January. They'd stocked groceries for 87 people in December. Some families were finding work, others were still figuring out rent. What came next would require razor-sharp coordination and the fierce dedication of a reserve army of volunteers, and often last-minute improvisation. Refugees were thrust into a safety net that had been slapped together. Whether it would sustain them or buckle under the strain was anyone's guess. "The quality control for client services is what I'm more concerned about," said Clark of World Relief Durham. He doesn't question the volunteers' intention, quite the opposite. "Most are compassionate, driven people, but good intentions don't always translate into effective service." In Clark's view, volunteers are being asked to fill shoes that were never theirs to wear. In the absence of a professional safety net, well-meaning people try to help, but the stakes are too high to rely on goodwill alone. Still, Clark said, the local response made a difference. He said, thanks to the generosity of our community and many churches, we were able to keep our clients housed and meet their basic needs, food, medicine, for those first 90 days. That's tremendous. I don't think that's the case in every community where refugees have been. In May, while the newcomers are still feeling their way through life in America, some of their helpers never came back. Chandler received her official layoff notice on April 11. Some furloughed staff, mostly caseworkers, from what she could tell, have already been called back, including Mangar's caseworker. The Human Resource Office told her the reason was budget constraints. But some volunteers, including the Nylands, suspected that with no new arrivals, her job of placing families in housing was no longer needed. Chandler said, it's like, well, bummer, but I knew it was coming. The newcomers have help and they're moving forward, but there's still plenty they don't know. Members of one JRC team helped organize a plan for a Syrian family they are helping. The mother is learning English through the Orange County Literacy Council. The children will attend 2 weeks of YMCA summer camp for free to refugee families in their first year in the country. Mangar landed an interview at a German manufacturing plant in Winston-Salem in late February. CWS, though stretched thin, had helped revise his resume and passed it along to an employment partner. His decent English gave him an edge. By March, he was assembling rotors and stators on a line for 8 hours a day. The hourly wage, $18, was enough to cover the $1,600 rent, but not much else. The family cut back to 2 meals a day. Sometimes his wife baked kisra, a thin Sudanese flatbread, and simmered a broth that stretched across both lunch and dinner. Mangar picked up a night shift that ran from 2 p.m. to 11 p.m. so he could be home in the mornings. Most weekdays he carpooled home past midnight. His wife kept a light on. The children were often still awake for a late dinner, and Mangar got them ready for school the next day. Their weekends were noisier. The children tore down the hallway, flipping through cartoons and streaming apps set up by volunteers. When a clip of South Sudanese dancers filled the screen, they all paused, silent, eyes fixed on the screen. Mangar watched them and remembered they used to dance like that at Sunday church in the camp. Even now, in a place where nothing was familiar, the sound of home found its opening. All right, Sarah Edwards, we were about one issue behind on her article, a short article about a new music festival coming. Last September, the International Bluegrass Music Association annual World of Bluegrass fell on the same weekend Hurricane Helene swept through the southeast. Several of those artists coming down from western North Carolina had to cancel as the festival trudged through its last year in Raleigh under rain and somber conditions. World of Bluegrass has since decamped to Chattanooga, lured by support from Tennessee's Special Event Fund. Now, Raleigh Wide Open, a free street festival emerging in its stead, will debut downtown Raleigh on October 3rd and 4th, a little over a year after Helene changed everything. David Brower, executive director of Raleigh nonprofit Pinecone, booked World of Bluegrass between 2021 and 24. He now manages booking for Raleigh Wide Open and says, there is a thread going through the festival, both on stage and amongst the artisans who participate in the art market, of people coming down to Raleigh from one of the 26 impacted counties and helping to tell the story. We're a year in, but those communities experience generational change. We really want to be part of helping artists continue to tell the story and make sure that folks don't forget they're still there and they're still going through it. Yesterday, Raleigh, this is as of May 28th, yesterday, Raleigh Wide Open announced its debut lineup. Balsam Range, one of the bands forced to cancel as part of that thread. So is Nest of Singing Birds, a Marshall collective of eighth-generation ballad singers. The collective draws its name from a phrase that the English folklorist Cecil Sharp deployed in 1916 upon hearing the ghostly, centuries-old ballads of Madison County. It's a music that continues through Nest of Singing Birds, which has held a monthly ballad swamp, ballad swap for the past 2 years at the decommissioned 118-year-old Marshall Jail, a space that was flooded by Helene's waters. Since then, Nest of Singing Birds has taken its ballad sweep, its ballad swap, why can't I say swap, on the road. Carrying traditions like that forward is a core tenet of Raleigh Wide Open. That's a festival whose logo features a squirrel proudly brandishing a banjo, a pine cone lolling pleasantly beside it. The name is drawn from a 2006 event celebrating Fayetteville Street's revitalization. By adopting the moniker, Brower says, the festival continues a tradition of bringing people downtown, showing off the heart of the city. Brower says the festival is designed to feel like a continuation of its predecessor to attendees, and that the Pinecone team, which has been producing World of Bluegrass since its inception 12 years ago, is not looking to reinvent the wheel. He says, quote, quite frankly, we're just having too much fun to stop. It's been wildly successful by just about any measurement, from economic impact to attendance to just downright good vibes, such that, you know, somehow fiddles and banjos have become a genuine economic driver downtown. Where Raleigh Wide Open may feel different is in its lineup, which reflects a broader definition of bluegrass music, incorporating roots, alt country, gospel, and more generally, music that has the feel of friends getting together to play tunes together, as Brower puts it. The lineup of 35 acts will play shows across 6 stages and includes traditional bluegrass names like Big Fat Gap and Jim Lauderdale, as well as a slate of local acts like Blue Cactus, Sonny Miles, and Joseph DeCosimo. Ticketed shows at Red Hat Amphitheater will be announced later this summer, and attendees can also expect the usual summery markers of a Fayetteville Street Festival: food trucks, craft vendors, and beer gardens. The festival will also feature nightly square dances. And Brower says, that's at the core of what Pinecone was founded to do, which is bring people together around fiddles and banjos for this shared cultural experience. There are so few things in life these days where we're actually together, moving physically with strangers, you know, reaching out to grab the hand of your neighbor and spin around a couple times, hopefully in time. And I can find a couple of minutes to read part of this article, which came out about a month ago by Lena Geller, about a popular pop-up bakery which is finding a permanent home on the American Tobacco campus over in Durham. After a year of pop-ups that saw locals lining up for pillowy morning buns in flavors like pepperoni pizza and pistachio honey, Lutra Bakery is getting a permanent address. The popular venture, nomadic to date, will become Lutra Cafe and Bakery, with a 2,600-square-foot location at the American Tobacco campus set to open by the end of this year. The brick-and-mortar will transform Lutra into a 7-days-a-week operation with full breakfast and lunch service, alongside buns, cookies, pretzels, yum, and breads. Chris McLaurin, Lutra owner, says, the entire time we've been doing pop-ups, we've been looking for a location. When I found out about the space in American Tobacco, I was really excited because it's a place I grew up coming to. The breakfast menu will include biscuits and gravy, bread pudding, breakfast sandwiches with savory buns sliced and toasted as their foundation, and a, quote, 100-layer hash brown made using the French technique pavé. McLaurin says he thinks the hash brown is going to be something we'll become known for. Well, yeah, I can tell you that I'll be over there. You have to slice the potatoes super thin with either a mandolin or meat slicer, and then you press them together with olive oil between layers and bake them. Once that's cool, you slice them into shapes, and then you deep fry them. Since there's so many layers, all the edges kind of separate and fry up and get crispy, almost like potato chips on the outside, while the inside stays really soft. Folks, I'm going to have to almost stop this article because it's way past my lunchtime. Anyway, that lunch menu will include sandwiches, soups, and salads. He says, when we really do craveable food, things that you take that first bite, you close your eyes, and you're like, I chose well. The space will feature an open concept layout with the kitchen visible from the entrance. Dining area will seat about 60 indoors with an outdoor patio for 20 more. Weekdays will maintain counter service. That's grab and go friendly, grab and go, but with space to linger and work. Weekend will shift to full service with a fun brunch atmosphere. He brings more than a decade of kitchen experience to Lutra. He trained at L'Académie de Cuisine before working at the acclaimed D.C. restaurants Comey and Little Sarah. And after returning to North Carolina in 2013, he cycled through local favorites, Rose's, Barlusconi Picnic, La Place, before landing as chef de cuisine at Ashley Christensen's Poolside Pies. When that closed in late 23, McLaurin got the kick in the butt he needed to start his own venture, he says. From the establishments where he's worked, he learned to balance high-quality food with an accessible vibe. The sweet spot is, he says, when you can really marry good food and professional but casual service. The name Lutra is Latin for the otter. It reflects the bakery's playful approach. In the past year, Lutra has hosted more than 130 pop-ups, including regular appearances at Cary and North Durham Farmers Market, weekly Sunday Bun Day events at Queenie's, and more. Well, I don't know how much in advance of that opening I'll have to go stand in line by the American Tobacco campus, but I probably will. Those potatoes sound really good. John Federson is going to have to run off now and eat something. And for Indie Week, he will say goodbye on behalf of the North Carolina Reading Service, the host for this and every weekly broadcast, which is now a podcast. We initially show it Friday afternoon, and then you can find this episode anywhere you like. So for the North Carolina Reading Service in Indie Week, John Federson says, farewell for now.